1324-00356 CV, United Concerts International versus the City of Hidalgo, Texas Municipal Facilities Corporation, DBA Payne Arena.
Honorable Court, opposing counsel, it's not a difficult case. In 2023, an entertainment business out of New York City entered into an agreement with Payne Arena to basically put on an event. There was a written contract. That contract is tab A to the appellate's brief. It sets out the terms. At the bottom of it, it's signed by both parties. It called for a liquidated damage clause in the event that either party breached it. There doesn't seem to be a dispute that the City of Hidalgo, DBA, Payne Arena, breached the agreement. The contract contained an arbitration clause in it. An arbitration clause set venue in New York. It was instigated. Payne Arena was given notice. Payne Arena did not show up. A default was taken. It was then, as it is in Texas, it was reduced to a final judgment. Payne Arena got notice of that. It came down to Texas. It was domesticated here, as was proper. Payne Arena got notice of that. After it was domesticated, Universal Attractions did what most judgment creditors do. It sought to enforce it, and it did so by filing a writ of garnishment. We got here because the writ was filed in the name of the DBA. Apparently, the DBA did not maintain a bank account in its own name. Lone Star Bank said, we don't have any of their money, okay? And so we went back and reloaded and went back after the municipality's bank account. At that point, the municipality hired legal counsel. They filed a general denial.
Why not go after the municipality from the very beginning?
Excuse me, sir?
Why not sue them as a municipal facilities corporation from the very beginning? Well,
A, you don't have to. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure is very clear. Rule 28 states you can be sued as a DBA. And to be honest with you, I think that's all these people knew, was that it was that they were dealing with Payne Arena. And so they sued them there. But that was completely proper, Your Honor.
But then that raises jurisdictional issues.
Excuse me?
That raises some jurisdictional issues. For example, and in your reply brief, you dismiss the fact that jurisdiction is proper in this court. But assuming that we should take up the issue of jurisdiction, what's your response?
Well, my response is this. The jurisdictional issue, all of this still should have been done through a direct appeal and not a collateral attack. Whether or not the name, because that's what we're talking about, Your Honor, whether or not the name was correct, okay? Whether or not service was on the right person, which are the two issues that they raised at the trial court level, both of those are an attack on an otherwise valid judgment.
But if we assume notice was proper, if we assume that they were sued in the proper name, and we have the issue of jurisdiction, which you're claiming they're raising it for the first time on appeal, what if we decided that that is properly before the court? How do you address the fact that they're arguing that the writ of garnishment, there's no waiver of immunity for a writ of garnishment?
Let me just deal with that. The Texas legislature decided that so long ago. Texas Government Code 271.1523 specifically states that if a municipality enters into a contractual arrangement, by virtue of having done that, they waive immunity. And it makes so much sense. Nobody would do business with the government, especially the local government, if every time you got up there and something went wrong, they said, oh, we didn't waive immunity. The legislature decided that. More importantly, on December the 5th of 2013, this very honorable tribunal, although be it other people sitting where you're sitting, came to the same conclusion. In the case of Arbor ET DBA ResCare versus Lower Rio Grande Workforce Development Board DBA Workforce Solutions, this very court determined that a workforce board was in fact a quasi governmental municipal entity, and when it entered into an agreement with a party to provide services, it waived immunity. Their argument about immunity, Your Honor, doesn't really go to the jurisdiction of the court to have done the default, to have entertained the domestication. They're trying to argue that you cannot garnish for consequential damages. If you look at their immunity argument, Your Honor, that's what it is. But here's the problem, and I hate to take us back to a really unpleasant place, first year law school. Okay, and in first year law school, what we learned was the difference between an actual damage and a consequential damage. An actual damage is Mark Weitz has been contracted to build a fence, because you people are so popular, around the courthouse, and you're gonna pay me $40,000. You breached. My actual damage is the $40,000. A consequential damage would be, because you people breached, I lost my opportunity to build a big segment of the wall between Mexico and the United States, and I was gonna make $4 billion.
But does Chapter 271 waive immunity for consequential damages?
But we don't have that here, Your Honor. What we have is an actual liquidated damage. The damage that we contracted for, that's an actual damage. A consequential damage is a damage that flows indirectly from the breach. So if in this case, not only do you owe me the money that we contracted for, but because you did this, that client got upset with me and I lost all this other business. That's a consequential damage. An actual damage is spelled right out in this agreement. And it's $60,000, which leads me to another issue. One of the things they kept trying to say in the plea to the jurisdiction, they argue it, but they don't ever come up with anything, and they did have the burden there, was we don't know that Mr. Trevino had authority. Well, if I'm going to file a plea to the jurisdiction, by gosh, I file something in there that says Trevino was dead, Trevino didn't work here anymore, Trevino expressly didn't have authority. Number one, they didn't do that, okay? Number two, we know he had authority. How? If you look at tab A of the appellate's appendix, you will see the contract. At the bottom of the contract, it talks about damages in the event of a breach. One of its provisions states that not only do I get my $60,000, because that was the contract price, but I can offset any deposit. If you look at the judgment, the judgment's not for 60 grand. The judgment is for 52 and change. Why? Because Universal Attraction had a deposit. They didn't get that deposit from nowhere. It had to have come from Payne Arena. And so once again, that deals with the waiver argument. I mean, when you do business with a municipality, when they, by legislative fiat, have waived immunity. There is not a consequential damage issue here. All we want was what was set out in the body of the contract. In fact, the damage is not only actual, the damage is liquidated because the agreement provides what it should be. All right? But once again, if we're going to raise that issue, because, I mean, once again, I'm going to take this back to law school. God, I hated that place. But anyway, I know everybody shakes their head. These folks have no idea. Anyway, the liquidated... I lost my train of thought trying to be smart. I guess what I would say is that the issues then that they raised at the trial level, I mean, it's black letter law. You cannot collaterally attack an otherwise valid judgment. And even though we would like to get in this now and try to get in an aspect, talk about this, on its face, it's a valid judgment. There, and they had two chances. They could have appealed this in New York, or they could have appealed it in Texas. And as Judge Fonseca has pointed out, they could have raised that issue. I mean, I know what I was gonna, I'm not naive to the fact that subject matter can be raised at any point. But it's not the question of can you raise it, it's where you raise it and when. And but in this case, like I said, they're not even arguing a subject matter jurisdiction argument as to the judgment itself. If you look at their argument, it flows to, well, you can't garnish for consequential. We're not trying to. Nobody wants consequential. It's a direct damage. It's spelled right out in the contract. And that being the case, like I said, we're back to black letter. I mean, people get sued in their DBA all the time. And the rule provides, okay, if we get to court, and boy, we don't like that DBA on a motion of any party, you can go to the real, to the upfront name of the entity. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Because the rule says you can do it that way. And the rules also say that it's one thing to say, I didn't get served. That's not been an argument here. Everybody admits they got served and noticed. The argument is, oh, you didn't serve the right
guy.
Well,
was Mr. Trevino receiving the notice? Whether does that constitute actual service?
It does. It does indeed. Because the argument is, well, they should have served somebody else. Who? I don't know. But the point is the argument, okay? Let's assume for a minute that the honorable court is correct, that wasn't the right person to serve. The problem is you cannot collaterally attack that. You have to do it through a direct appeal. And like I said, I'm not that bright. This is the law that was being created by people much better at this than I am. You simply can't do it. And that's where we're at. I mean, none of this, there's not a lot of smoke and mirrors here. And the larger question it begs is this. If you get notice, and they did, whether, okay, service is one thing, but notice is another. I think we would all agree. They got notice of what happened in New York, and then they got notice of the domestication in Texas. If that's really your position, now it's time to step up and file an appeal. But you don't do it the way they did it. You cannot collaterally attack an otherwise valid judgment. And when a judgment in this state has been properly domesticated, it is entitled to full faith and credit, and it is incumbent upon the judgment debtor to come forth and prove that it's not a valid judgment.
But it brings us back to my original point on whether or not the writ of garnishment, whether there's a waiver of immunity for the writ of garnishment, the procedure that you chose to recover from the judgment was through garnishment.
Correct.
When there are other ways in which to recover from a municipal entity.
Your Honor, that's true. But Your Honor, before he sits here, sat down at the district level because I was before you, and I can guarantee you that one day I'll bet you stood here. When you try to, executing on property, I mean, has anybody ever done it? You give it to the sheriff goes out there and said, well, I looked around, I didn't see anything that was non-exempt, and we're done. Garnishment is the most prevalent, most popular, and the most effective way to collect. Because under the rules, you get to file the garnishment and then notice the debtor after you've done it. I mean, it would have almost been malpractice to not have tried to garnish. Okay? And once again, we're not talking about consequential damages here. We're talking about very direct damages. And I'll be honest with the court. In my career, I have stepped outside the bounds there and had to magnanimously give it back. We sued a bank one time, and I garnished the bank's account. It was like $500,000 in it. Man, I was pumped until I saw the statute that says, you can't do that. So I gave it back. But what I'm saying here is there's no prohibition. In fact, the statement that you can't garnish for consequential damages is almost an admission that I can garnish for actual. And that's what we did. Like I said, nobody was trying to be sophisticated here or do something novel. We went with the most preferred method of execution, and to be honest with you, it brought us here.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I believe this case is a, like Mr. White said, I think it's very straightforward. I think the first thing that, that in terms of what the facts that the court needs to focus on is that under the Uniform Foreign Judgments Act, you have to first present a judgment on its face that appears valid. In this case, the only judgment that they have alluded to is one that says Payne Arena. And Payne Arena is not Hidalgo, I'm sorry, the City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation. The judgment doesn't identify City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation.
Well, did anyone ever tell the appellant we're actually a municipal facilities corporation, or the City of Hidalgo is actually the one that created this entity? Were they kept in the dark? What happened?
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is that they, I mean, for whatever reason, I mean, there's no evidence of how this transpired. I guess what I'm telling you is that the Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation was not aware of this judgment until they got hit with the garnishment and proceeding.
Does Mr. Trevino have the authority to execute these contracts?
No, Your Honor, he does not. He does not have the authority to do so. He is not a registered agent of the Municipal Facilities Corporation. He's not the president of the Municipal Facilities Corporation or anybody authorized to accept service for it. So
has he been reported to the authorities for signing this contract on behalf of the Municipal Facilities Corporation?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor. No one has made any report of that nature.
Is he still employed?
I am unaware of that, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't know. But the way that the argument proceeds, Your Honor, is that the first thing I need to say is that governmental entities are immune from garnishment and executions of judgment. That's Delta City Levy Improvement District versus Leonard 516 Southwest 2nd 911. That's a Texas Supreme Court 1974. And the policy behind that is that you don't want to have, you know, it's whatever the municipality owns, whatever the government owns, that's public funds. And that's kind of the public policy. You don't want private debtors coming after the city for or taking public funds. But this whole proceeding that they filed, they can't get past the immunity that the Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation enjoys. And so
how do we hold cities accountable when they are liable?
Right. The 271-152 in the local government code indicates how a waiver of immunity is obtained when suing a governmental entity. And that process there's a lot of case law on it. It's fairly straightforward, but you have to, number one, have a written contract signed, properly executed by the governmental entity. And so when you have an entity that is required to adhere to open government, and you have to have an agenda item indicating we are going to approve the contract with so-and-so, you get the, it goes onto the agenda, you have the meeting, it gets the votes. After the votes are taken, it's reflected in the minutes. The person authorized to sign the contract, whether it be the county judge or a mayor or the president of the corporation, signs it. After it's signed, then you have a properly executed contract that meets with the requirements.
I understand that, but it'll fast forward. You have a lawsuit. I recover against the city. How do I execute on that judgment if the city's immune from the writ of garnishment?
It doesn't, Your Honor. They're immune from execution and garnishment. That's what the Texas Supreme Court law says.
So exactly. So then, every time I sue the city, I just get an expensive piece of paper and I can never recover from the city if the city chooses not to?
No, Your Honor. Most of the time, cities will have insurance policies.
Most of the time. But what happens when you don't have that willingness? What if you have a mayor and a city commission that is hell-bent on saying, I don't care what the judgment says? How do you actually go and recover the monies that have been adjudicated in favor of the litigant?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, they don't get anything because
in general, not in this case.
Well, in general, Your Honor, that it would be the same result because the binding case law says that governmental entities are immune from garnishment and execution from judgment. And so, if you have a case where, for example, it's a sexual harassment lawsuit or an employment claim, most of the time you'll have insurances that are set up for the municipality or the whatever governmental entity. That's typically the way those, that's the way the cities are able to pay litigants when they obtain a judgment against the city. And that's just in an employment context. But for example, a school district, a bus hits somebody in a car, same thing. That's where they've allocated an insurance policy to cover those claims. In this particular case, the only way that you're able to obtain a recovery is if there was a contract. And if the contract was properly executed under 271-152, then there would be a way for the city to pay it. But because there's not a properly authorized contract, and so there, in other words, there's no city meeting where we can go back and look to see whether or not this particular contract was approved in the minutes. And that's the way that you do it in order to assure or have the evidence to establish that a contract was in fact properly authorized by whether it's a city commission or a county commissioner. It doesn't matter what it is, but that's the proper way to do it. If that was done, then they'd be able to say your immunity is waived and we can, you have to pay us the judgment. But in terms of your particular question, Your Honor, the answer is they can't, because the governmental entity is immune from garnishment and execution, and that's the law, Your Honor. And it's been like that. That's a 1974 case, by the way. And it's been like the other one is Veterans Administration versus Keys, 706 Southwest 2nd 101. That's a 1986 case talking specifically about garnishment, which happened here. But the other reason, and I disagree respectfully with Mr. White's, just because when the hearing occurred, counsel was asked at the hearing to describe what sort of damages the UCI was pursuing. And I, in my brief, there's a rendition of what was said. And so at one point, the trial court asked during the hearing of UCI's counsel, says, okay, so this was a projection based on a concert that was going to take place. And so calculations were made, and this was the projected amount. And the answer to the question, I believe Ms. Gutierrez said yes. And so what ends up happening is that the court was advised that this concert never took place. And so if the concert never took place, the only damages that they're requesting are consequential damages based upon, I want you to pay me for something, but I didn't perform, right? And so you can't do that. The only waiver of immunity that is possible is a waiver based upon things that are due and owing for work that was already done, for things that have been, the house has been built or the construction for a school has been made. And then if you have an amount that indicates what has been incurred in the past, then you can recover under 271-153. But in this case, it's not. They're trying to recover for a performance that did not take place. That is by definition a consequential damages that is not allowed by 271-153. And because that's the type, they've admitted that's what it was, and that's on page 21 and 22 of the brief. And so
isn't lost business a direct damage? I could have performed in San Antonio, instead of the Valley, and now I missed out my opportunity to perform in San Antonio, and I'm out $60,000. Isn't that a direct actual damage?
Not under 271-153, Your Honor. You have to have something that you can only recover for things that have actually occurred or actually taken place. Work that was actually occurred, and they, in other words, you have to go build, for example, I'm just using a construction example. You got to go build a house. The house is built, and there's no dispute that the house was built. And then the municipality or the governmental entity says, or they don't pay. Okay, at that point, that is a damage that's due and owing to the government. And so that claim for you need to pay me for what I've actually done, that is the only element of damage that's allowed under 271-153. You cannot get something prospectively or be provided with some compensation for things that did not occur. Admittedly, they admit to that at the hearing in this case, they admitted that this was a concert that did not occur. And so it is by definition a consequential damages for which they cannot recover. And the other thing, probably the most important thing, is that if we assume service is right, if we assume that they were actually sued, if we assume that there was even a properly signed contract where the board approves whatever city commission it is, They approve it, everything's signed. Even if the lawsuit is brought for consequential damages, the law does not allow, or excuse me, there is no waiver of immunity that will take place because you're suing for something other than actual damages. And so there's many cases on that. The actual damages issue has come up in a variety of cases, but it's the law is very clear. That's the only thing that they can recover for. The other issue that I think we need to address is this Rule 28 issue. And under the law, I understand that they're contending that Payne Arena, that the Hidalgo, City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation was doing business as Payne Arena. But, you know, in a plea to the jurisdiction, you can submit evidence when there's jurisdictional facts that are at issue. There's zero evidence that they submitted into the record. There was the contract that they are asserting was binding, was not submitted into evidence. Nobody testified to anything. And so they didn't meet their burden to plead or prove any sort of waiver of immunity. And that's just evidentiary wise. But in terms of Rule 28, the law is very clear that it's this the Chickowitz versus Heisen case, 22 Southwest 3rd, 825. That's Texas Supreme Court, 1999. And the law is very clear. It says that at some point before a judgment, the plaintiff must amend the petition and add the correct legal name of the defendant. And so Rule 28 is a purely procedural mechanism. It does not constitute any substantive right that's given to a party. So what that is, in essence, you can go ahead and sue a DBA, somebody doing business as, but the Supreme Court case law says you have to substitute the name of the proper legal party before the judgment is rendered. And there's many cases on it. That's the one I believe I cited two or three in the brief, but that is not, it is a condition for them to be able to have a valid judgment. And because they didn't do that, there's the judgment that they're asserting from New York, which was an arbitration award. It doesn't identify the City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation at all. And so because they did not substitute the name of the proper defendant, then they don't have a judgment that is valid or enforceable. And so, that's probably the biggest part of how their arguments fail. It's just they didn't do what the law required them to do in that respect in terms of an assumed name or not. I mean, Rule 28 lets you sue somebody, but you got to get it right before the judgment is entered. And just so the court knows, Your Honor, this is not something that, you know, no one's laying behind a log here. You know, you can go to the Texas Secretary of State's website and determine, you know, do your public records are all there for the City of Hidalgo. This is a public,
but not facility. For Payne Arena.
I'm sorry,
but not for Payne Arena.
Well, if there is, well, I disagree, Your Honor, because when you have a DBA certificate, they're all filed at the county courthouse. So if there is a DBA assumed name certificate,
is there?
I'm sorry.
Is there one?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Then how would they have known?
I'm sorry?
So then why? How would they have known that this was a DBA?
No, what I'm telling you, Your Honor, is that if it doesn't exist, then it doesn't exist. I mean, the brief and what was said to the court was there is a sponsorship agreement between Hidalgo, City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation and the Payne Auto Group. And that sponsorship agreement allows the Payne Group to put their name on the arena. That's just so that they can get notoriety from the name. That's the only reason why it's named that. Previously, it was named State Farm and then something else because of the sponsorship agreement. But the sponsorship agreement is not an assumed name certificate. It doesn't constitute some sort of, that's what it's named. That's the name of the car, right? So it'd be like, it's a Chevy Malibu. Malibu is the name of this Chevy. And that's really all that it is, Your Honor.
So if we disagreed with you and sent it back to the trial court, then you engage in discovery to see whether or not Mr. Trevino had this authority and how many other contracts you've signed. I mean, how do we know about whether or not Mr. Trevino acting or signing on behalf of Payne Arena, because that's how he signed in the contract. I mean, is that what we're going to do? Are we going to go back and just open it up and then see how many vendors are in this position?
Well, I don't know what, I mean, with respect to this particular case, Your Honor, Mr. Trevino is an employee of the City of Hidalgo, not an employee of the City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation. So that was explained to the court at the hearing in this case. And so I can answer your question that way by saying that this individual was not an agent or employee of the appellee, which is the City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation. I believe counsel for the city indicated that he was an employee of the city, which is separate from the MFC, Municipal Facilities Corporation. And so that, in my mind, has been resolved. But, Your Honors, if you choose to send it back, then I suppose that some discovery will be done. But as dealing with the record that is before you, dealing with the evidence that they were able to submit, there's no testimony. There's nothing. All you have at the plea to the jurisdiction is, number one, a understanding that the City of Hidalgo Municipal Facilities Corporation is a governmental entity incorporated under Chapter 431 of the Transportation Code. It is a governmental entity, and it only performs governmental functions. It doesn't perform proprietary functions by statute. And so that's not in dispute here. And because it's a governmental entity, it's got immunity. And because it has immunity, you have to do certain things in order to obtain a judgment. None of those things were done. When the hearing on the plea to the jurisdiction was held, a plea to the jurisdiction based on a disputed jurisdictional fact question, you can submit evidence. You can submit testimony. They submitted zero testimony. They submitted zero exhibits into the record. There's nothing. All they did was argue. And so, I mean, I'll give you an analogy with a case that I had one time. We had an arbitration, a motion to enforce an arbitration agreement. And we all go to court. And the lawyer stands up and says, Your Honor, we filed the agreement with our petition. It's in there. We filed it. But we're at the hearing. And I object. Your Honor, I object. It's hearsay. It's not authenticated. We're disputing it. And they didn't have any witness. They don't have any business records affidavit to submit it. The rules of evidence applied here. The rules of procedure applied here. They had the opportunity. No one took that away from them. They were given notice of the hearing. The law allowed them to put evidence on. They didn't do anything to substantiate their position. They didn't even admit the contract itself that they're suing upon. And I cited the law in my brief, Your Honors. Just because you attach something to your petition under Rule 59 does not mean that it's authenticated and properly admissible in the court of law. It's not. And again, they don't make any dispute that they were not afforded the opportunity to do it. That is not in dispute. It's just they showed up and they weren't able to submit any evidence. And so on the record base before you, Your Honors, this is what has to be the result. You have to affirm the trial court's judgment because there is no waiver of immunity. And even if there was a waiver of immunity for the suit, governmental entities are immune from garnishment and execution. And so I believe the only thing that this court can do is affirm the trial court's judgment and dismiss the case as it were, Your Honors. I mean, there's no way out of this. They didn't even attempt to put any evidence into the record based upon the hearing that they had. And so with that, Your Honors, I don't really think that there's any other way that they can get around this. But I just want to leave you with one last thing. The Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act requires them to submit a judgment that's on its face appears subsisting invalid. They didn't do it in this case, and they didn't do it because they never identified who the appellee is here, which is City of Hidalgo MFC. That name doesn't appear on any of the documents that they filed. The first declaration that they had to file, a sworn statement saying that this was a foreign judgment, that one also said it's Payne Arena. Payne Arena is just a name from a sponsorship agreement. It is not an assumed name for the City of Hidalgo MFC. It is not. It is not an assumed name for, I mean, I don't think, it's just, like I said, it comes from the sponsorship agreement. That was told to the court. They never met their burdens here, Your Honor. They never submitted any evidence. And with that, I would ask the court to affirm the trial court's
judgment. Let me ask a question. What remedies, if any, do they have, in your opinion, today?
Your Honor, I don't believe they have a remedy.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Escobar.
Thank you.
Mr. Weitz, 5 minutes.
Yes, ma'am. Everything opposing counsel just said in the last 20 minutes was properly raised on her direct appeal and is not the subject of a collateral attack. We had a valid, subsisting, domesticated judgment. We had no obligation to put on any proof. It was their burden to show that it wasn't valid. My understanding is this is the last argument that will ever be made in this court. And I would like the record to reflect that I didn't show up when the bar opened, but I closed it down. And I'd like to leave you with this. We exist in a society today where people just define their own reality. Now, this is what it is because I say it is. And I realize that this puts this tribunal in a difficult place. Because if you come with me, you're going to have to rule against a local municipality. In 1962, John Kennedy spoke at Rice. Most everybody in here is probably not alive. I'll give Judge Pena credit only because his hair is the same color as mine. In that speech, after chastising Rice for playing Texas, Kennedy went through a litany of things that he proposed. And when he got to the end of the list, he said, "We do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard." This court invites the difficult. American jurisprudence is hard. We let criminal defendants walk free that we know killed someone because the search took place in the trash can on his property without a warrant and not after that trash was dumped in the public trash disposal. I know it's hard. And I'm asking you to do the hard thing. This case is clear. What they've been trying to do is essentially collaterally attack something that can only be done on direct appeal. You know, I hope I'm 67. I hope I'm in the autumn of life. We all hope for an Indian summer. But I can tell you without certainty, with no uncertainty, that I'm in the winter of my legal career. I'll probably never see all of you again, okay? But I would leave you with this. I've been coming here for 25 years. All right? And it might be the most enjoyable place I've come. Because at least when we get here, we're above everything that we know that exists below us. And this tribunal burns clear all of that rubbish. And it looks, this is the law. This is the result. And yes, it's difficult. But this is what we do. And I've been on the end of both of those coming to this court. And I can still say that I would rather have done it than have gone someplace else. And so I will leave you and this place and tell you that the proper remedy here is to reverse and render. Send us back. Let us enforce our judgment. Because we did everything proper. And despite any of the arguments that you might have heard today, they were not properly raised. All of this is the subject of an improper collateral attack on an otherwise valid judgment that can only be challenged on direct appeal. And I wish you all luck in your new venue, and I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you. Thank you.
Judge, if I could ask a question.
Yes, sir?
Have counsel attempted mediation?
No, Your Honor, because I guess here's what happened. Mediation has never been, and I know that's possible, but I mean, and this is just me talking about looking at the procedural history of the whole thing. It just went bang, bang, bang. Okay, you know, the arbitration happened, the default happened. I mean, before you knew it, we were here. So the answer, the long answer to a very short question is no. It has not been.
Okay, that's correct, Your Honor. I do not believe it's been.
Well, let me just say it's my suggestion. I'm just one here, but that this seems to be a case that ought to be mediated. You all are both intelligent lawyers with good clients who know what's going on. This seems to be a case that perhaps could be resolved.
Well, one of the things I have learned in the last 25 years is that you can order that.
Well, I'll speak to my judges. But let me just say we've in the past.
And I understand, and I don't disagree with the court.
We've seen situations like this where we've suggested mediation, and clients have.
I'm a huge believer in it. Okay, after 41 years, I can't even say that without choking. I've seen fights that just turned into Charles Dickens's Bleak House. That by the time it was over, the subject matter of what we were fighting about was gone. So I'm a big believer in it. And I will, of course, in deference to Your Honor, will make that suggestion.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is under submission.